Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do the honors of introducing our guest this hour.
Yes, thank you so much, On. I'm really excited about the interview today. Our guest is lawyer Sasha Bookert. She is the Non-Binary and Transgender Rights Project Director at Lambda Legal in Washington, D.C., where she challenges policies that discriminate against LGBT people. Welcome to the show, Sasha.
Thanks so much, Xander and Dr. An. Great to be here. Thank you.
You bet. I typically like to let the listener know if I know the guest firsthand or personally. Sometimes I don't remember, but we have known each other for quite a while, actually. I don't even remember. I'm not sure if it was when you were at the Transgender Law Center or maybe through the Transgender American Veterans Association, but we met when I was still living in the Bay Area, which was quite a while ago. So it's been a number of years.
Yeah, I lived with Tristan for a couple months when I first moved to the Bay Area, and I met you at a party. I remember meeting you there in person. I was like, oh, that's Xander. It was really great.
That's
So yeah,
right.
It's been a few years for sure.
Now, are you talking Tristan Cotton?
Yes.
Yeah, Tristan's been a guest on the show twice now, once as an
Oh,
individual
nice.
And once he was on a panel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic. Well, I'll say hello now. Hello, Tristan.
Yeah, I'll pass it along as well. Sasha, let's just jump right in and we'll talk a little bit about the work that you do at Lambda Legal, but please feel free to talk about what it is that led you into doing this particular trans law, not only at Lambda Legal, but the Transgender Law Center, and just maybe that journey there and anything you'd like to talk to us about. We'll just have a conversation.
Sounds great. Yeah, I am from the Portland, Oregon area originally and went to law school in Oregon. And before that time, I had purposely avoided really looking at the law with regard to trans rights in particular, and you know, just because it was too close. I just was trying to avoid it. But after coming out and living openly and authentically, I began to dip in, and I just became outraged and was really, really upset about the barriers that trans people experience in the law on so many levels. Marched down to our data quality group, Basic Rights Oregon, and insisted I get some kind of work. I didn't care what. I wasn't looking for money. I just was, hey, just get me onto a working group. I don't really care what it is. I just want to be a part of the community and to be involved. That one thing led to another. I ended up working for them for a couple of years, which was an amazing experience. And so many good people. We got so much great work done there. And after being there for a couple of years, the Transgender Law Center down in the Bay Area, who is a national organization, was hiring for a staff attorney. And I thought, wow, that sounds like me. So I put my name in the hat, and thank goodness Alona, the legal director at the time, interviewed me, and we had a great conversation, and they took a chance on me, and it felt like it was a great fit, and really got to work on some amazing groundbreaking cases there on that, along with some. So there was a job that, you know, came open at the Transgender Law Center that was perfect for me. It was staff attorney working on issues in their national organization, and Alona was the legal director at the time, and interviewed with her, and everything went well, and I feel like it was a great fit. They made an offer, and I came down and worked in the Bay Area for about 3 years, and it was just a wonderful experience. Got to work on a ton of groundbreaking landmark cases that are still binding case law precedent that really made a huge difference. Got to work on some really amazing public policy initiatives that really moved California to the front of the line with regard to trans rights in particular. So just a really great time. And then I've been there for a while. And then after the election in 2016, I just knew that things were going to get bad here and with the first Trump administration, and just wanted to be a part of the fight. And Lambda Legal had a job that came open, and this is perfect for me too. So I applied, and fortunately they brought me on board and got to work on that there, and just have been here for now 7 years and loved every minute of it. Just wonderful colleagues and really, really smart and kind. And it's just been a pleasure to be here and working on these cases and public policy issues and shifting public opinion. You know, that's the one piece of the work that I think gets less discussed, but I think it's so important. I just want to give a shout out to all our communications and all our community members and everybody that's doing the work to put a face to this issue. We're such a smaller community than like the LGB community. It's so hard to connect with people. I always joke about this. I think we need a TV character like Will and Grace or something, you know, because it's just, it's such a gap for people's understanding of who trans people are. It's just really important that humanization and a connection happens. So that's a really big piece of what I've tried to do in my career. And I'm just so impressive to see from organizations across the country doing right now.
Well, first off, I'll say thank you so much for the work that you did and that you're doing. I wonder if you could give us at least one, maybe two examples of some of that groundbreaking work that you did in California. Just, I think it'd be helpful for people to understand what's at stake here when it comes to trans people.
Yeah, for sure. At the time, we worked on a case that was pretty groundbreaking, and I got to be the one to pitch it. So I was really proud of moving that forward. But it was involving a case with a federal employee who had been discriminated against. And the government at the time was saying that, well, she isn't protected under federal non-discrimination law. And we argued that she was. And the EEOC agreed with us and issued a really powerful decision in support of her. It was Tamara Lusardi was the plaintiff in that case. We also worked on a case involving a prisoner who was being denied access to sex reassignment surgery and won a really powerful decision in that case on behalf of a trans woman named Michelle Norsworthy and a number of public policy initiatives. I think one thing I'm probably the most proud of was we moved forward and led the work to establish a third gender marker on state issued ID and to move to self attestation. And that was like one of the first states to really do that, both of that together, which means that you didn't have to present a doctor to say that your gender is what it is, a doctor's note to say that your gender is what it is. So I think those things are probably things that I'm really proud of during my time at TLC, and the work to shift public opinion was really, really great too. I got to work with people like Mason Davis and Chris Hayashi and Jen Orthwine, just so many great people. It was just an amazing experience.
I had a really good time living in San Francisco and being part of the trans community and being able to network and work with those individuals, some of those individuals that you mentioned, and become friends with them. It was an exciting time. It was so much happening, so much change at the city county level, at the state level, at the national level. There really was a lot going on. I know Mason Davis has gone on to international work now. So it's pretty phenomenal to see people who started out maybe working in a local area. He did as well, right? In Los Angeles with, I think, United Way, and then went off to the Law Center and then off to this international thing. And you went from, you know, Basic Strike Oregon to Transgender Law Center, now Lambda Legals. Even though Transgender Law Center is national, I think one of the differences is that Lambda Legal, as far as I understand, has multiple offices. I think the TLC might have stretched out to a southern office with a project or two. I'm not sure if that's still up and running. But with Lambda Legal, there are people, if there's not many offices, I know you have people spread out all over the place. You might be working on state legal things. But nowadays, on the national level, I know we recently texted back and forth. It was about a day before the Supreme Court hearing on the Scarametti case. I know there's probably not things you can talk about, but to what degree were you involved in that? And if you have the ability to make any comments about how you think it went on that day. I did listen to the arguments. I'm not sure if a lot of people did, but I'd love to hear your legal analysis if you're able to give that to us.
Yeah, happy to pontificate. Yeah, Lambda Legal's been around since 1973. And also want to just say that I loved working at Transgender Law Center. They just didn't have anybody in DC working on the public policy issues. So that's really what drew me here. But Lambda Legal's great too. We've got offices in Chicago and New York and Atlanta and LA and DC and Dallas. And we've been around since 1973. And yeah, we work on state public policy issues. We work on state litigation. We have cases all over the country and against the federal government. You know, so we'll have many, many more in the coming years, I'm sure. With regard to the Supreme Court case, yeah, it was a case involving one of the healthcare bans that was passed in Tennessee. It's part of this wave of anti-trans legislation that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years that is just horrific. They are not just one or two issues. It's book bans, it's sports bans, it's bathroom bans, it's healthcare, it's everything you can imagine, pronouns, you know, it's just this massive attempt, this onslaught to go after 1.4% of the population. It feels like the far right spends 99% of its time working on that 1.4%. The healthcare bans is something that they've really seized upon because it is so important to families with trans kids and trans youth in them. And it's just been horrific to see the impact of those bills. Families are having to make really hard decisions about splitting up their family to make sure that their kid can get the care that they need, and just the devastation that this has wrought. I don't really know what's happening in this country. I'm not a political scientist, but it's just really difficult to witness. But again, we're fighters. That's what I do. We're warriors, and we'll continue to battle this and stand up and fight for our community. The one thing that's concerning about these bills is that they really, and I'll get to the case in a minute, sorry to go such a tangential route here, but I think it's just important to talk a little bit about the junk science and the misinformation that's out there that's really being weaponized by the far right to justify these bans. You know, every major medical association in the country has clarified so many times, so repeatedly, this care is essential, it's medically necessary. So we're talking about the American Medical Association. And what do they have on the other side? They've got junk science. They've got people who don't submit peer-reviewed research in journals. They just give their opinion. That's enough for a lot of these folks because they're clearly ideologically based. They're not following the science. They're following their ideology. But they have the political power in some of these places, especially in the South and the Midwest, where the state legislatures are so fixed with the supermajority, Republican supermajority, conservative far right creates a dynamic where misinformation is allowed to flow freely. And we've started to see some of this in the courts, and it's just deeply unsettling with, for example, the mifepristone stuff. The evidence that's being used to support the bans or surveys from anonymous parents from a far right anti-trans website is enough for some people to justify banning care altogether, which is insane. And the courts aren't buying it either. It's one thing to make these specious arguments in state legislature or to media, but when they have to actually produce facts and produce evidence, they haven't been successful. And even in the case before the Supreme Court, the district court in that case was a judge that was appointed by the Trump administration, looked at all the evidence and all the BS arguments that are made continually about how this is dangerous care, looked at all the evidence that they had to provide, and none of it held any water for him. And that's just what we've seen repeatedly across the board, even in really conservative parts of the country like Arkansas and Florida and in Texas. Just not the courts see through this BS, and the court issued findings of fact clarifying that they just haven't made their case, and issued a really strong injunction saying that, look, you know, this ban violates the rights of parents to provide the best care for their kids, and it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution because it makes a distinction on the basis of sex. It provides the same care for non-transgender kids, but then makes a distinction based on your sex assigned at birth to deny that care to transgender kids. Sometimes when we talk about gender-affirming care, it sounds like it's this care that's provided just to specifically to trans people, but that's not the case. Kids take puberty blockers and hormones for all kinds of reasons other than gender dysphoria. And it's medically sound in those circumstances. It's medically sound for trans kids. And that's what the evidence shows as well. So the district court issued a really powerful injunction, and then it got appealed up to the circuit court. And the circuit court, with a chief judge who had been one of the only judges to uphold a marriage ban, by the way, so clearly has some very clear views about LGBTQ people, reversed the district court decision on grounds that really didn't make any sense. They just lowered the level of scrutiny. They said this isn't sex discrimination because it's just a medical regulation, and ignoring the fact that, yes, it's a medical regulation, but you still have to make a sex-based decision. It should get the appropriate level of scrutiny. And that was what the argument was about that went to the Supreme Court, was that the circuit court should have applied the right level of scrutiny when they assessed whether the regulation is justified by the reasons the state gave for the ban. And that's not even a slam dunk win in itself. The court could still come back and say, well, they did, even applying this higher level standard of review based on this being a form of sex discrimination, it's what we call an intermediate scrutiny rather than just like a rubber stamp. It's saying, you have to show your work, basically. That's all you have to do. And we might still justify the ban, but the circuit court didn't even want to go that far. They just wanted to rubber stamp it and say, trans people just don't get any protections here. And so that's what we said to the Supreme Court, with the first ever openly trans person arguing, by the way, Mr. Chase Strangio, who's amazing and a genius, made the argument in front of the court a couple months ago and was just absolutely stellar and did a great job, as did the Solicitor General, Ms. Bree Logar. And the court, it consists of some pretty conservative folks, hard to read tea leaves or figure out where to go. You know, I'm cautiously optimistic they'll issue ruling, sending it back to the circuit court to just demonstrate their work, just show your work. why force the state to show its work about why they think this is justified. It's hard to be too optimistic given the makeup of the Corps right now and some of the decisions, including the Dobbs decision that we've seen over the last few years. But we'll see. We'll see in June, and we'll still continue fighting. The outcome of that case could have pretty wide-ranging consequences on the work that we're doing in the court, depending on how it goes. But however it goes, Lambda Legal and other organizations will continue to fight for the community.
Do you find that what you're running up against is the concern by some of the agencies and clinics and universities who are trying to determine what they can or cannot do? Do you hear from people at those levels?
Not me personally, but I know that we do as an organization. We're in touch with people that are in those places. And yeah, I think there's a ton of concern. I think in light of the EEO, the executive order that was issued just as of yesterday, time is a little difficult right now, but they are seeking to strip federal funding from hospitals and research entities that get federal funding that provide care for pediatric gender affirming care. And unfortunately, what we've seen, and it's a little bit of a meme, I don't know. I mean, when they talk about fascism, people say, well, the first thing is to not comply automatically. And unfortunately, we are seeing, I think people are really, really afraid right now. And I understand that. But what's right is right is right. And what's wrong is wrong is wrong. And it's just so important that people stand up right now. But yes, we hear concerns all the time from not only folks in institutions, but from communities about how worried they are about losing federal funding, about being investigated, and all of the things that come with the far right move to erase LGBTQ people from public life.
Well, first off, I just want to say thank you for giving us that, getting to the specifics. You gave us a bird's eye view, something like that. I forget what it's called. You nutshelled it. Maybe that's it. What the Scrimeti case was about. I love that you provided some of the contributing factors. I was a little surprised to hear you say, you said something about such a small population, one point something. And I'll tell you why I'm surprised to hear such a low number. I think it's because I keep seeing either articles or images, infographic images, showing such a higher percentage of younger people identifying as trans or non-binary.
Yeah.
When you look at the generations, the number you gave, I would imagine that fits boomers. And then for me, I'm like Gen X, it might be a little bit higher, and then millennial a little bit higher, and zoomers a little bit higher, but then maybe it averages out, and maybe things, demographic information might not be keeping up with policy work. And so I was a little surprised to hear such a low number, because I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe transsexuals, and I still use that term. I use it for myself. Okay, that makes sense. But now there's so many different identifications, labels that are used within quote trans community. And so I'm wondering, when you use that percentage, are you meaning the people who want to legally change their name and sex marker or gender marker, wanting to have hormones and probably some surgeries? Or are you meaning there's a smaller number of us who are medically transitioned versus the larger community of us, and how were differently affected by this?
Yeah, I think the main point just, and it's not a great point in some ways, because it's just like discrimination is wrong, pure and simple. But just to step back and just say, why is this such a huge priority for the entire government to choose to, on day one, issue executive orders, and day two is executive orders? All through the week, we're seeing our federal government prioritize, of all of the issues that we're facing as a country, both domestic and internationally, transgender people is what they're really focused on, which is shocking to me, given the small population of, and I think they don't have abortion to talk about in the ways that they used to talk about it, and they need to rally their base and have people have something to hate. And I'm just trying to make the point that this is what's happening right now. And that's why it's so important to humanize transgender people in this moment, because they need to coalesce their base with hate. And the destructiveness of that approach is just really, really harmful. And as far as where the numbers come from, you're right. I've heard different estimates. And I think that the number of youth is definitely higher than the number of adults who identify as transgender. I always just look to the Williams Institute, which is a statistically based for putting these numbers together. And that number comes from, I think, people that might not identify as non-binary or genderqueer or somewhere in between. I think it's mostly people that identify in a binary way with a sex that's different than their sex assigned at birth. But I have heard larger numbers, but nothing over 5% for sure. So I think it's just a larger point that we just have to step back and ask why this small population. They spent, I think, $200 million at the end of the Trump campaign on ads targeting transgender people in particular. And this has been a talking point and a priority for them all the way through. And I just am stepping back and asking why. I think it's because, again, it's something to gin up their base, and they feel like this makes it difficult for people who support us to come out and stand up in this moment, and because of that empathy gap. So I guess the long and short of it is the main point I'm trying to make here is just the importance of defending our community for sure, but also just the importance and the dire need to humanize our experience and the trans experience in this country.
We are taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is senior attorney Sasha Bookert, the non-binary and transgender rights project director of Lambda Legal. Sasha challenges policies that discriminate against LGBTQ people. We are grateful to our sponsors and therefore grateful to play their commercials. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is attorney Sasha Bookert. Let's get back to where we left off.
I thought of a thought experiment. I wonder if you'll go along with me just to
sure.
See. Because I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get into the mind of somebody who takes an opposite position. And I'm wondering what was going through their mind when, for example, that memo came out in June of 2016, or 30th, to be specific, saying that transgender people were going to be able to serve openly in the military. And I love this topic because we're both veterans, right? And so I thought we could pivot into it. I wonder, did some people think, wait a minute, this is such a small group of people. Why are we paying so much attention to a small group of people being able to serve in the military? Or why are we paying so much attention to a small number of people who may be incarcerated? Do you think they might be having a similar perplexed response? Why is our government doing all of this for such a small group of people? Do you think that's possible that we got these two sides going, each are scratching their head going, why so much emphasis on such a small number of people? Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would just turn it around. I would just ask, look, if somebody, we're talking about the military service, for example, I would just say, look, if somebody can do the job, I've never heard of somebody that seeks to serve or who is serving who felt like they should have some other standard applied to them. If they, you know, I've seen them testify repeatedly that if you can't do the job, you shouldn't be able to get the job. They're not asking for special rights. They're just asking to be treated equally and to be subject to the same generally neutral standards that everyone's subjected to. What's happening here is that, for example, in this most recent ban, this argument that, well, what we want to do is we want to make sure there's a meritocracy in our government doesn't hold any water for me, because this is clearly not about meritocracy. If you want meritocracy, look at the actual experience of trans folks serving in the military or in the employment or going to the bathroom or whatever. You know, it's one of the things that actually drives me out of my tree is the way in which the far right just parades this endless speculation and hypothetical scenarios. Look, we have had open service, for example, for 10 years. Go look at the statistics. Go look at whether people have been able to deploy to austere environments. Go look if there has been violence in restrooms involving transgender people as perpetrators. Go look and see what's happening in high school sports when transgender athletes are participating before you decide you're going to categorically do X, Y, or Z. You should have some basis in fact and reality before categorically doing anything. But that's not what this is. This is ideologically driven, and the Trump administration didn't spend 10 minutes looking at the statistics or talking with commanders before issuing this horrific executive order. And I think that's just I would just flip it and ask why so much attention is being focused on this small, vulnerable group of people rather than just letting them go do their job. The question shouldn't be who you are, it should be what you do.
I'm not sure if I've talked about it on the show. I might have. And I believe you know this story about me, that I worked during the first Trump administration with the Navy on their Navy Medicine West transgender care team. And I was there for about three and a half years when I left, and I didn't leave because there was anything wrong with the team. Even the ban, we still took patients every day or at least every week. So it never stopped. People kept being referred to us. But when I did leave, I think I had about 300 sailors and Marines and a couple of Coasties. As a Coastie myself, I was always happy to work with the Coasties. So I was there from the very beginning. And then after the tweets and all of the chaos that created, and I remember being there, and I'm still in touch with a lot of people, not patients, but people I used to work with. And so I started contacting all these people to be like, how are things going? Because I know people attached to the Air Force team in San Antonio and the team in San Diego for Navy Medicine West. And so I was wondering how are things are going. And so I'm just checking in with people. And of course, right now, there's so many unknowns because it's just an executive order. There's no change in policy yet. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I'm curious. It's either, the question is either how or why, but I'm not exactly sure which one. I'll start with, how do you think that the message of, as you say, the far right, right, that messaging, why do you think it's been so successful that so many LGBT people and liberals and Democrats have joined them? During the Scarametti hearing, there was a bunch of people outside, two different camps, the for and against, and the quote against people, the people that want Scarametti to stand. A bunch of the speakers were lesbians and gay men, and I'm not sure if they had trans people, but why is it, do you think, that that message has been so successful that they stand behind, for example, the CAS review out of Britain, the National Health Service's independent review of the gender clinic there, the Tavistock Clinic? I'm just wondering, are there conversations behind the scenes where people are trying to make sense with, how were they so successful in getting people to agree with them and then vote for Donald Trump for president?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. I think that, first of all, the speaker lineup and the way the far right does this is all stacked. They intentionally sought out the gay and lesbian people that could would have that impact, the visual impact. Not even the LGBT community supports this, so it's clearly rigged. I think that there's probably LGBT people that supported Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And, you know, I think that's just, we can't expect, we're not a monolith of our community. So there's people that are going to have, we still have the log cabin Republicans who have opposed trans issues for a very long time.
I remember meeting people who part of the LGBT community, or back then we were LG community, who didn't support same-sex marriage or open right. service for gay and lesbian people because they didn't support the military and they didn't support marriage. It was too heteronormative or too industrial complex for them. So some people didn't support it for that reason. And then there might've actually been people who didn't support it just for I'm gay and I shouldn't be in the military, maybe.
I don't know. But I think the danger with that is in my opinion, is that the negative people, the people that are opposed or whatever, they tend to erase the tens of thousands of supportive LGB people of trans people, you know, that I know in my own life and are in the world that are so loving and supportive and beautiful. So I just think we shouldn't give them too much airtime, you know? So, but I think that, not to beat the same drum here, but I think that as far as like why this has been successful, and it has, is that, again, they don't have abortion as an issue. So they've really seized on the lack of public understanding about transgender people as this wedge issue. And they just demonize and demonize and demonize. And this isn't new in our country. It used to be the case for gay and lesbian people. I'm old enough to remember the ways that gay and lesbians were depicted in the 1980s. And this is not that far away from that. And they're just seizing upon the public's lack of understanding and acceptance, and that Hollywood's partly to blame. They've depicted us in stereotypical ways that have been really harmful for many years. It's hard to go back and look at a sitcom where trans people aren't being made fun of in some way up to at least 2014. It's really shifted. We have an Academy Award nominee. It's like a problematic film, I guess, but it's just things are really shifting and the culture shifting. That visibility is also bringing backlash to some degree. You know, I thought things were going to be going on the right road after the Tipping Point Time article. But I think that visibility, I think this is true for every human rights struggle. And I do believe in that saying that first they ignore you, which they have ignored trans people forever. And then they laugh at you, which they've also done forever. And then they fight you and then you win. And this is the fight. And I can't say this is going to be over in 3 years and that we're going to finally win. This is the struggle of a lifetime. And it's not just about transgender people. It's about immigrants. It's about people of color. It's about women's rights. It's about bodily autonomy. But I think, to answer your question, I think that they've just been able to seize on. I think people are scared right now, and for a number of reasons. Economically, things are shifting. The country is changing demographically, and that has probably helped spark a backlash because we're not the country of the 1960s. And I think people are scared about that, which an issue on its own, I guess. But I think that there's just whatever the factors are, I think that the great work that we're doing just needs to continue. And when we fight, we win.
That saying that you just repeated a little bit ago about they ignore you and then they laugh at you and then they fight you and then they win. I think the what goes along with they win oftentimes and then they take credit as if, oh, it's always been this way. I've always liked these people or I've always believed this, right? We haven't memory holed everything. I think I remember, I think it was when I watched the Gandhi movie that he made that reference to that time lapse of how things go with social movements. It's so fascinating. And I do remember, I'm also old enough to remember the gay rights movement. Mm-hmm. Hey, we want to be able to not be fired from our job. One of the things, we had a gentleman on the show a few months back, Jonathan Rauch, and he was part of the emergence of the new gay rights movement that separated from the queer rights movement. So the queer rights movement was, who cares about the military? Who cares about marriage? They wanted to get rid of all those things. And so Jonathan Rauch and Andrew Sullivan and some others, they said, hey, wait a minute. We want to be able to live in neighborhoods and have jobs and have families, get married, maybe have children, be safe and go in restaurants and hotels. And so they wedged away, they pulled away, they severed from the queer rights community and started working with, working with a guy at Focus on the Family to try and get them to come along with them. And I think they were successful enough that now people are like, oh yeah, gays, who cares? Gay marriage, everybody's for that. They got to that place. And I've asked a few guests on the show what they think about, have we reached a similar point in the trans rights movement that there might be competing interests and there needs to be a pulling away from or a severing from to try and go a more centrist route, which is what the gay rights did from the queer rights. Do you think that's a plausible thing to do or not? I'm just curious about as far as where does the movement go from here? Because clearly whatever we've been doing is just so upsetting that the pendulum is smacking us in the faces. So what's the way out of this? And is it trying to find a way to go in a more centrist or moderate or collaborative or consensus with people to try and say, like you said, humanize us in a way that they'll start going, oh, well, I didn't realize my thoughts are changing. Do you think it's possible, and how might we get there?
Ooh, yeah, I'm just a boring lawyer. I'm not sure if I have a great response to that. I think there are already, you know, a pretty wide range of different approaches to trans rights generally. I think the important piece of this, again, is the importance of humanizing and bringing down the barriers that exist between non-transgender people and transgender people. That's just so important. And I don't think it ever helps to scream at people, but in blame or violence, of course, or hateful rhetoric. But I do think it's also important to not compromise important rights, you know, because I think that that's a dangerous road to go down too. So I don't know, I probably fall somewhere in between there. I think that it's always good to work with people to find solutions, but I think that you have to find people who have good in their heart. Whereas I think right now, unfortunately, in the moment, I think that there are a lot of people that are trying to score political points on the backs of transgender people, unfortunately, and it's just a little dangerous time. So, but I think there could be a lot more dialogue for sure, and more conversation for sure. And I think I just applaud, you know, the work that's done in really hostile states among trans families and trans people and allies that go to state legislatures and provide testimony and go and lobby and talk to people and make calls to state legislators and to write op-eds and to be willing to talk to media about their experience and to just explain to people that we have dogs, we like ice cream, we have dreams, we want families, we want to have love. I think things are beginning to change. I really do. More generally, again, if you just look at Hollywood as a metaphor, you know, the fact that we are starting to see more openly trans representation, I think is a sign that things are shifting a little bit. And we have our first openly transgender member of Congress, which is so huge. I know that it's at an unfortunate time in the middle of, maybe it's they're correlated, but certainly is a huge step forward. And I think that that will be helpful, and we need to break a lot of firsts. We still haven't had our first, you know, federal judge. You know, we've got plenty of state judges, so that's great. More attention needs to be provided there. But the first, like Chase's first in arguing in front of the Supreme Court. You know, these things are really significant culturally, I think, and that's just such an important part of this work is the court of public opinion. So I guess that's where that word salad is where I'll leave that conversation.
No, that was really helpful, actually. A lot of executive orders have come through. So let's see, we've got there's only two sexes, no more trans. They're probably going to say, oh, you could be trans in the military. You just have to serve in your birth sex, right? Isn't that always the argument? The argument used to be, oh, gay people could get married to somebody of the opposite sex. But that was the argument. No, you can serve, but you might have to serve in your birth sex. And then there's the no more gender-affirming care for kids in any federally funded location. There might be others, but it's the one that people keep asking me about has to do with passports. There seems to be a lot of focus on passports because we all have state birth certificates and state IDs or driver's licenses. And so the federal government isn't going to dictate to California or Pennsylvania how to issue birth certificates or IDs or driver's license, right? That's left up to the states. But at the federal level, I guess that would be the passport, would be the equivalent. I'm on a couple of Discord groups and with like FTMs, trans guys, and there is a lot of concern about that. And I have to renew my passport next year. And I wonder what it's going to come back as. And somebody said to me, well, what happens if your passport comes back as female? And I said, well, if that happens, I'm hopeful that there will be some sort of policy or procedure or process that I can follow, that maybe it's a return back to carry letters, if you remember carry letters.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
We are taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg, and our guest this hour is senior attorney Sasha Bookard, the non-binary and transgender rights project director of Lambda Legal in Washington, D.C. We'll be back shortly.
UK House Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
May I introduce you to Frequency Medicine from BioHealthScan? It's a brilliant new way to achieve optimal personal health safely, scientifically, painlessly. Find out more about our 21-day challenge. Google biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge or ukhealthradio.com for details of our amazing 20% discount offer. Discover what you can achieve with BioHealthScan and enjoy a 20% introductory discount into the bargain. BioHealthScan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at ukhealthradio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is senior attorney Sasha Bookert, the non-binary and transgender rights project director of Lambda Legal in Washington, D.C. Sasha challenges policies that discriminate against LGBTQ people. Let's get back to where we left off.
Terry letters before trans people in general in the day, the transsexuals, before they could get their IDs changed or their driver's license or their birth certificates changed, they would have a mismatch. If they ran through a stop sign and they got pulled over and they handed their driver's license to the police officer, they'd see a name and a picture and they'd look at the person and there'd be a mismatch because the person was in transition or maybe had already medically transitioned. So we carried around these letters. I had one for a really short period of time. It was by a physician on their letterhead. It was notarized and it said, I am this person's physician. They're in my care. They're female to male or male to female transsexual. It was it was language like that back in the day. They are undergoing, we didn't really talk about transition. That language wasn't used in so many words. They're on hormones or their appearance is going to be changing. We'd have to hand that over at the same time so that they would understand that we weren't providing them with a fraudulent identification card. And that's what I said to somebody. I go, maybe that's what we're going to have to go back to unless this all gets resolved and it never comes to fruition. But
we use them now.
Harry letters are still being used?
Absolutely.
Oh, why?
So for purposes of being approved for HRT.
That's a letter from a therapist to a doctor, but that's not the same as that you would show to a...
No, I understand that, but you'd think we would be further ahead, right? But we're not. It depends on the doctor. If they practice by that protocol, then they expect a letter. If the person is undergoing surgery, then many of them expect that letter unless they're not part of, for instance, WPATH. Then they don't. They can do whatever they want.
We never had to show those letters to law enforcement or airport security. I just want to keep the distinction because I'm curious what would happen if I got an my passport came back, my renewed passport came back with my picture and my name and F on it, what's TSA going to do, you know?
Isn't your birth certificate, didn't you update that, Xander?
Well, I did in California, but the thing is that, and that was back in 2005, and my original birth certificate is sealed. So, but the federal government has the ability, I would imagine, to look in the Social Security Administration system records and say, oh, in 2005, this person applied for changing their name and their sex in the Social Security Administration system. Oh, and this person served in the U.S. military as female. So that's their birth sex. So we're going to revert their passport back.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I think it'll just be more of a hassle for them. I think what they're probably going to do is for people, they're probably, who knows, they're so vicious. I don't want to give them the benefit of the doubt. My guess is that they'll just process the renewals without trying to change them back. But you do have to identify, I just renewed mine before the administration took place, and you do have to identify that you had changed your gender when you do it. They will have that in their hand when they get the renewal application information. So there is a possibility they could re-change the gender marker, but I doubt it. I mean, I think they'll probably just deny future requests to change the gender marker or request to put an X gender marker on.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
The X's are going to go away at the federal level.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. Something that surprised me, I learned this during the last administration, during the Biden administration, that administration never changed the Selective Service registration requirements. So it still required anybody who was male sexed at age 18 to register with Selective Service. And I always thought that was interesting that there were so many changes at the federal level. There was policy or procedure or executive order around trans people and all the different ways in which they made those changes, but not Selective Service, like register for the draft for people who are unfamiliar with that. We have a lot of listeners outside of the United States. Did you know that was one of the things that never changed?
I remember sending an email or two about it, you know, in like 2021. But yeah, I had forgotten about it, to be honest. So that's interesting.
I know. I was, well, wait a minute. You're saying one thing, but this is clearly saying another thing. I was always a little confused by that. Why the inconsistency?
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't have control. Maybe that's a congressional thing. Some things only Congress can do.
I mean, there were a few things that I don't want to beat up on the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, because they did some really amazing work. But there were a few things that were left undone that were disappointing. We really tried to push hard to get them to eliminate the categorical regulatory language prohibiting care for veterans. And that just didn't get across the finish line. But they did a ton of great stuff. So I don't want to criticize for sure, including their brilliant defense of trans kids and trans people in court.
With veterans, do you mean the initiation of surgeries?
Yeah, there's a regulation that prohibits gender alterations, and we're trying to get them to remove that.
My hope is that it doesn't go backwards now, that we don't lose some of these things that we've already had. I started on hormones at the VA in 2005. I've been getting all my trans care through the VA, except for some surgeries since then. So it would be a big deal to lose it all of a sudden.
For sure. I could see myself going to the VA. I found out a few years ago that I had served in Camp Lejeune during their water issue. And so I could see myself returning to the VA very soon, unfortunately. But
that paperwork. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Sasha, this has been a really fun conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm so happy that you were able to come on the show, and we covered so many different topics that we don't normally cover. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Sasha.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You were listening to our guest, Senior Attorney Sasha Bookert, the Non-Binary and Transgender Rights Project Director of Lambda Legal in Washington, D.C. You can check out Sasha at Blue Sky, Sasha, B-U-C-H-E-R-T dot B-Sky, S-K-Y dot social. Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.